Temujin, later Genghis Khan, was born around 1162 near the border between modern Mongolia and Siberia. Legend holds that he came into the world clutching a blood clot in his right hand. His mother had been kidnapped by his father and forced into marriage.
As he was born, he emerged clutching a blood clot the size of a knucklebone dice in his right hand. To this boy, they gave the name Temujin.
The shamans interpreted the blood clot as a sign from heaven, a sign Temujin, the future Genghis Khan, would become a fierce warrior.
In the legend that grew up around Genghis in later centuries, he was meant to be not the child of an ordinary person, but the child of the sun himself. So there's room for the belief that his birth was supernatural, and that heaven presided over his birth, and that his destiny as a world conqueror was a heavenly ordained destiny.
At that time, dozens of nomadic tribes on the Central Asian steppe were constantly fighting and stealing from each other, and life for Temujin was violent and unpredictable. Before he turned 10, his father was poisoned to death by an enemy clan. Temujin's own clan then deserted him, his mother, and his six siblings in order to avoid having to feed them.
Genghis's father had two wives. The boy's mother had been abducted from her previous husband in another tribe. As a boy, Genghis grew up with three brothers, a sister, and two half-brothers. His earliest years were spent hunting, riding, and roaming the plains. As part of a nomadic society, his clan were constantly on the move, seeking new pastures whenever the grazing for their sheep was exhausted. Genghis is reported to have grown up as a brave and defiant young man, his only fear being dogs. Yet he was an introvert who preferred to spend the bulk of his time alone with his thoughts. He was fiercely independent, seeing no value in consultation with others. As he emerged into his teens, it was apparent to all that he had a sense of his own destiny, and that destiny lay far beyond the clan that was then his world. As was the custom, at around 9 years old, Genghis's parents arranged a marriage for their son. His wife-to-be was named Berta, who was from a neighboring tribe, and Genghis was to be transferred to that camp so that he could grow up alongside his bride. On the return trip after delivering his son, Genghis's father met a party of Tartars on their way to a hunting expedition. They seemed hospitable, offering him food and drink. However, the offerings, they were laced with poison, and 3 days later, his father died.
Shortly thereafter, Temujin killed his older half-brother and took over as head of the poverty-stricken household. At one point, he was captured and enslaved by the clan that had abandoned him, but he was eventually able to escape.
He, his mother, five brothers, and a sister are now cast out to live on the barren steppe.
They were expected to die, but they did not die. And Genghis became, as it were, his own father. And he had to rebuild the family, make sure they survived.
Their only shelter is a tent, the kind many Mongolians still call home today. How would these traumatic events affect a 9-year-old boy?
It's impossible to overestimate the effect of the death of his father and his subsequent exile that would have on a young boy. He would be confused, lonely. He could become angry, vengeful, lash out, and kill everyone.
And even as a boy, Genghis Khan has the tools to kill. The Mongolian composite bow. Genghis will use this weapon to take on the world. But first, the young boy uses it to seize control of his own family.
There's one person that stands between Genghis and the top position, his half-brother.
Begtar, the half-brother, is older and thinks he can bully the teenage Genghis. But nobody bullies Genghis. He kills his own brother. The killing is a prelude to a career of slaughter. Genghis is growing up in a hurry.
The killing of his brother shows us that Genghis Khan is ready for adulthood, ready for leadership.
In 1178, Temujin married Borte, with whom he would have four sons and an unknown number of daughters. He launched a daring rescue of Borte after she too was kidnapped, and he soon began making alliances, building a reputation as a warrior and attracting a growing number of followers.
I had just one friend I could trust, Jamukha. As children, we had sworn the vow of Ander. It was the most sacred vow of all. We were blood brothers, a bond that joined our lives as one. But to take revenge, I needed more than just my blood brother.
Temujin and Jamukha sought an audience with the one man they thought could help. He was a Khan, the leader of an uneasy alliance of tribes. His name was Toghril. Many years before, he had fought alongside Temujin's father.
I reminded the Khan, he was once my father's blood brother. I told him, he was as a father to me. A man who seeks power needs friends who have power. There was only one thing I had to offer, the sable fur. His judgment would decide my future.
Temujin's reaction to being accepted by the Khan is recorded in the secret history.
With the friendship of Toghril and my sworn brother Jamukha, my power had been increased by heaven and earth.
At the Merkit camp in the mountains of northern Mongolia, Temujin went looking for his wife.
We destroyed their families and emptied their breasts.
Temujin, the man who was to become Genghis Khan, was barely 20, and he'd already eliminated one of Mongolia's great tribes.
Most of what we know about Genghis Khan's childhood comes from the secret history of the Mongols, the oldest known work of Mongolian history and literature, which was written soon after his death. Going against custom, Temujin put competent allies rather than relatives in key positions and executed the leaders of enemy tribes, while incorporating the remaining members into his clan. He ordered that all looting wait until after a complete victory had been won, and he organized his warriors into units of 10 without regard to kin.
In the wake of the overthrow of the Merkits, Genghis went from strength to strength. He united with the clan of his boyhood friend, Jamukha. The two men became inseparable, declaring themselves blood brothers. They lived together, ate together, and slept together. This roused the jealousy of Genghis's wife and mother, who began to spread rumors about Jamukha in an attempt to drive the two men apart. Whether it was the influence of the women in his life or his own lust for absolute power, something caused Genghis to sever the bond with Jamukha. In 1185, the two clans were moving towards fertile grazing grounds when Jamukha decided to turn off and camp in a valley. He called to Genghis to join him, but Genghis ignored him and kept on riding. Carrying on a mile or so, he turned in his saddle to see that not only had his own clansmen followed him, but many of Jamukha's men had as well. Genghis was now developing the largest following of any of the Mongol clans. This was achieved partly through the desire for security in numbers and partly by coercion. Those who did not agree to give Genghis their allegiance, well, they were forced to do so. The combination of his desire for power and wealth and his need to feed his ever-expanding following led to repeated raids on other clans, the capture of their women, and the plundering of their belongings. The Secret History of the Mongols attributes a quote to Genghis, which may be familiar to fans of the 1982 movie Conan the Barbarian, in which the words were given to Arnold Schwarzenegger's character. "The greatest pleasure is to vanquish your enemies and chase them before you, to rob them of their wealth and see those dear to them bathed in tears, to ride their horses and clasp to your bosom their wives and daughters."
Though Temujin was an animist, His followers included Christians, Muslims, and Buddhists. By 1205, he had vanquished all rivals, including his former best friend, Jamukha.
Temujin revolutionized the steppe world. Each victory brought more warriors to his side, and he reformed the Mongols into an army. The decimal system was implemented, and the army was divided into tens, hundreds, thousands, and ten thousands. Transfers between the units were forbidden, and if one man deserted, the other nine in his unit were put to death. Commanders were chosen by their men, except for the commanders of the ten thousands, so-called tumens, who were hand-picked by the Khan himself. This chain of command allowed flexibility, discipline, and loyalty, and was vital to performing sophisticated maneuvers. Every able-bodied man had to be a part of this structure. In 1201, a number of opposing clans called a council, Kurultai in the Mongolian language, and declared Jamukha the Khan. This sparked a five-year war between him and Temujin, and the latter managed to defeat his former blood brother at the Battle of the 13 Sides.
The following year, he called a meeting of representatives from every part of the territory and established a nation similar in size to modern Mongolia. He was also proclaimed Chinggis Khan, which roughly translates to Universal Ruler, a name that became known in the West as Genghis Khan. Having united the steppe tribes, Chinggis Khan ruled over 1 million people.
Jamukha's own bodyguards, the men who should be most loyal, betray him. They hope to save themselves by handing him over to Genghis. They don't realize they've broken Genghis's golden rule.
When he's confronted by men who've defected, even though they've defected to him, they have an underlying disloyalty. Disloyalty cannot be tolerated.
The traitors are beheaded. Jamukha suffers an agonizing death. Genghis orders that his back is broken.
In order to suppress the traditional causes of tribal warfare, he abolished inherited aristocratic titles. He also forbade the selling and kidnapping of women, banned the enslavement of any Mongol, and made livestock theft punishable by death. Moreover, Chinggis Khan ordered the adoption of a writing system, conducted a regular census, granted diplomatic immunity to foreign ambassadors, and allowed freedom of religion well before the idea caught on elsewhere.
Much of what Genghis Khan is credited with on the upside, right? So things like religious toleration. And you'll say, well, he was religiously, the Mongols were religiously tolerant. And so this makes them almost like a liberal reformer kind of thing. But this needs to be seen within the context of their empire, which was very much like the Roman viewpoint, which is the Romans didn't care at a lot of time what your local people worshipped. They wanted stability. And if that kept stability and kept you paying taxes and didn't require the legionaries to come in, and then they didn't care, right? And the Khans were the same way. Like, they don't care what you're practicing as long as it doesn't disrupt their empire and cause them trouble. But what I always like to point out is, yes, but the Khan could still come in with his representatives to your town, decide your daughter was a beautiful woman that they wanted in the Khan's concubine, and they would take them. So how liberal an empire is this, right? So many of the things that they get credit for as though they're some kind of nice guys may, in another way of looking at it, just be a simple mechanism of control.
Chinggis Khan's first campaign outside of Mongolia took place at Zizia Kingdom of northwestern China. After a series of raids, the Mongols launched a major initiative in 1209 that brought them to the doorstep of Yinchuan, the Zizia capital. Unlike other armies, the Mongols traveled with no supply train other than a large reserve of horses. The army consisted almost entirely of cavalrymen, who were expert riders and deadly with bow and arrows.
In 1209, the Mongols began their first invasion against the powerful Western Xia state to the southwest. The details of this conflict are not clear, but it seems that Genghis Khan was successful in open battles, but had difficulties taking the well-fortified cities. The Mongols learned the importance of siege warfare in this campaign. The surrounded cities slowly succumbed to starvation and diseases, and the Xiao Emperor had to submit to Genghis Khan and become his vassal. Up until this point, the Jin dynasty underestimated the Mongols as a nuisance on their northern border, and even refused a call to aid by the Liao. But by 1211, they were on high alert. They even demanded Mongol submission, which led to war. In March 1211, Genghis Khan summoned all Mongol chieftains and prepared to wage war against China. The Jin had a massive population and mobilized around 800,000 infantry, most of which were untrained peasants with low morale, and 150,000 highly trained heavy cavalry. This vast army, however, was spread across the Great Wall and garrisoned separate fortresses. Meanwhile, the Mongols had a 90,000 strong cavalry army, which had three main components: light cavalry scouts, horse archers armed with composite bows, and heavy cavalry armed with lances and curved swords. All of these men were highly trained and loyal.
At Yinchuan, the Mongols deployed a false withdrawal, one of their signature tactics, and then initiated a siege. Though their attempt to flood the city failed, the Zijia ruler submitted and presented tribute. The Mongols next attacked the Jin dynasty of northern China, whose ruler had made the mistake of demanding Genghis Khan's submission. From 1211 to 1214, the outnumbered Mongols ravaged the countryside and sent refugees pouring into the cities. Food shortages became a problem, and the Jin army ended up killing tens of thousands of its own peasants. In 1214, the Mongols besieged the capital, Zhongdu, now Beijing, and the Jin ruler agreed to hand over large amounts of silk, silver, gold, and horses.
Genghis Khan was so confident of victory that he left his army to capture the city. The final command to his generals was to order total annihilation. For 1 month, his army plundered, burned, and raped. A year later, visiting foreign ambassadors described the streets as slippery with human fat. They also recorded that beyond the walls stood an entire mountain of bones. Genghis Khan's fearsome reputation grew from the destruction and carnage he practiced in Beijing, but what he now created at Karakorum in central Mongolia revealed an entirely different nature. He wanted Karakorum to be a great trading and cultural center. Here, in stark contrast to his nomadic origins, he began to establish a permanent capital. And he wanted his fellow Mongolians to benefit from his conquests. Captured Chinese citizens were brought here to teach the great secrets of their culture. He established a medical corps trained by Chinese physicians. He learned the technology of the Chinese military.
When the Jin ruler subsequently moved his court south to the city of Kaifeng, Genghis Khan took this as a breach of their agreement and, with the help of Jin deserters, sacked Zhongdu to the ground.
Heaven has abandoned China owing to its haughtiness and extravagant luxury. But I, living in the northern wilderness, have not inordinate passions. I hate luxury and exercise moderation. At military exercises, I'm always in the front, and in time of battle, I'm never behind. In the space of 7 years, I have succeeded in accomplishing great work and uniting the whole world in one empire. I have not myself distinguished qualities. So opens a letter from Mongol Emperor Genghis Khan in 1219. emphasizing his qualities and extreme humility, it's easy to imagine this as part of the many ultimatums the Mongols sent demanding submission by the will of the eternal blue heaven. However, this was not sent to any monarch, but a Taoist sage, and the letter goes on to describe the graces of Chu Chuji, begging him to come and provide his wisdom, and the secret to eternal life, to Chinggis Khan.
In 1219, Chinggis Khan went to war against the Khwarizm Empire in present-day Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. The Sultan there had agreed to a trade treaty, but when the first caravan arrived, its goods were stolen and its merchants were killed. The Sultan then murdered some of Chinggis Khan's ambassadors.
The rules of hospitality, which Genghis Khan considered sacred, were broken, and he started planning his retribution. He gathered information from the Silk Road about his enemies, assembled siege engineers from China, and created a plan involving separating his army into three columns. The numbers for both sides are highly disputed, but most scholars agree that at the start of the campaign, the Mongols outnumbered the Khwarezmian forces with 100,000 against 60,000. In the winter of 1219, Genghis Khan sent his oldest son Jochi and Jebe to cross the Tian Shan mountains to ravage the fertile Ferghana Valley with around 20,000 men. It was risky, but paid off, as they slipped through the defensive lines and confused the enemy, who thought this was the main force. Meanwhile, another army under his second and third sons, Chagatai and Ogedei, passed through the Dzungarian Gate with haste and besieged Otra, which had a garrison of 20,000. After 5 months, a deserter opened the gates and allowed the Mongols into the city. Otra became the first of many settlements to have its entire population slain or enslaved before it was razed to the ground. Inalchuk was captured, and reportedly had molten silver poured into his eyes and ears. Muhammad II was preparing a strong defense around his capital, Samarkand, but Genghis tricked him by traversing 300 miles across the Kizilkum Desert, which was considered impassable, hopping from oasis to oasis. The Mongols found themselves at the gates of Bukhara. The city's defenses were weak, so the desperate defenders tried to sally out and meet the Mongols in open battle, where they were massacred en masse.
Despite once again being outnumbered, the Mongol horde swept through one Khwarezm city after another, including Bukhara, Samarkand, and Urgench. Skilled workers such as carpenters and jewelers were usually saved, while aristocrats and resisting soldiers were killed. Unskilled workers, meanwhile, were often used as human shields during the next assault. No one knows with any certainty how many people died during Genghis Khan's wars, in part because the Mongols propagated their vicious image as a way of spreading terror.
Genghis's empire endured after his death through a series of laws he developed and the capable children he had raised. He had tried multiple times to deal with the looming question of succession. Before the campaign in Khwarezm, he gathered his four sons in a tent and prepared to break another Mongol tradition, according to which when a father died, his domain was inherited by the youngest son, while the herd was divided between the rest. Genghis Khan, however, urged his sons to maintain the unity of the empire they helped him build, and asked Jochi to take the floor and speak his mind. Before he could say a word, Chagatai, who rumors claimed was the real firstborn to Genghis, insulted him, saying that he was not one of them and that he would never follow him as Great Khan. Genghis decided the best way to keep the empire intact was to give each son lands where they could settle and rule as long as they respected the Great Khan. The third son, Ogedei, would be the one to ascend to the throne. Jochi was promised Persia and Europe. Chagatai was given Central Asia. Okutei would get China, while the youngest, Tolui, would take care of Mongolia. And so, this family dispute over the empire of one man led to lines being drawn all over the known world, creating a division which put the Mongol legacy in danger.
When Genghis Khan returned to Mongolia in 1225, he controlled a huge swath of territory from the Sea of Japan to the Caspian Sea. Nevertheless, he didn't rest for long before turning his attention back to the Zizia Kingdom, which had refused to contribute troops to the Khwarezm invasion. In early 1227, a horse threw Genghis Khan to the ground, causing internal injuries. He pressed on with the campaign, but his health never recovered. He died on August 18, 1227, just before the Zizia were crushed.
Europe, in the year 1241. Although Genghis Khan had been dead for more than a decade, his legacy lived on. Priests prophesied a coming apocalypse as Mongolian hordes approached the borders of the Holy Roman Empire. The whole continent watched and waited in terror. Drawing from the Book of Revelations, they saw the invaders as the armies of Satan. Their fears would soon be realized. The Mongol army descended like a storm. The knights of Europe faced warriors the likes of which they had never seen before. Fearless in battle, moving at lightning speed on highly trained horses, armed with bows able to penetrate the strongest armor, Mongol warriors had yet to be defeated. And they were now within striking distance of the very heart of Europe. Genghis Khan was no longer alive. But his legacy, passed on through the pages of the secret history of the Mongols, was all too real.
Genghis Khan conquered more than twice as much land as any other person in history, bringing Eastern and Western civilizations into contact in the process. His descendants, including Ogadai and Kublai, were also prolific conquerors, taking control of Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and the rest of China, among other places. The Mongols even invaded Japan and Java before their empire broke apart in the 14th century. Genghis Khan's last ruling descendant was finally deposed in 1920.
Genghis Khan accomplished what no other human before him had ever done, and what none have done since. Through brutal military force, he amassed one of history's greatest armies, and built the largest contiguous empire the world has ever seen. Second only to the British Empire in terms of overall size, Khan's Mongol Empire controlled much of Asia, and laid claim to a quarter of the world's population during the 13th century. His conquests not only changed the ancient world, but the ripple effect can still be seen today. For example, some fairly recent research has suggested that 0.5% of men worldwide, about 16 million people, can most likely trace their genetic lineage back to male line descendants of Genghis Khan.
His story, produced and packaged by Larry Shorby.